From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is going to be made next weekend at the annual Climate Solutions Summit in Rochester. The focus this year is on health, equity, and climate, and you've probably heard these concepts linked in various ways in recent years. The summit aims to explore them in more tangible ways, because you've probably seen headlines in some form or another. I'm going to read a few that you might have missed over the years. This is from the BBC, Why Climate Change is Inherently Racist. From Brookings, The Case for Climate Reparations in the United States. The United Nations headline, The Global Climate Crisis is a Racial Justice Crisis. The NIH links climate change to health inequity. Greenpeace asks, is climate change racist? With those ideas in mind, what do we do about this? Next weekend's summit aims to address many related issues. They've listed some of the following: how climate change impacts health today, what's the relationship between climate change and social determinants of health, what role does the healthcare industry play in alleviating the impacts of climate change on public health, how can equitable climate solutions improve health outcomes and quality of life? We've asked some of the folks involved to join us this hour, and I'll welcome our guest now in studio. Abby McHugh Griffith is Executive Director of the Climate Solutions Accelerator of the Genesee Finger Lakes Region. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Jane Van Dis is with us. Dr. Van Dis is Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Lamir Turan is with us. Dr. Turan is Associate Professor in the Department of Earth, Environment, and Equity at Howard University. Dr. Turan, thanks for being on the program today.
Good morning. Thanks for hosting.
Well, it's great to have you. And it turns out Dr. Turan, from what I've been reading, has plenty of connections to upstate New York and has done a lot of work in this area. So there's a lot to talk about and a lot of different angles. But let me just start by asking Abby if you want to tell listeners the dates are next Friday and Saturday, the 19th and 20th. And who you want to be there next week?
Well, of course, anyone and everyone, but specifically day one, our target audience is people who are there with their professional hat on in some way. Maybe they work in the healthcare sector, in the social service sphere, or just in another organization that is looking to address its climate impact. So that's day one, Friday the 19th. Day two is Citizens in Action. So if you are a citizen who's concerned about climate change and interested in learning more about the connections between climate, health, and equity, we would love to have you there.
And where do people register? Because they can do it through at least until a few more days, right?
Yes, registration closes on Monday, so please don't wait till the very last minute. But go to our website, it's climategfl.org.
Okay, and you know, Abby, I read one of the headlines. I could have read one more here. One of the headlines, the Greenpeace headline was, is climate change racist? A separate headline said, climate change isn't racist, people are. Mm. Which, you know, is actually quite pertinent. And I say that because someone's going to email me and say, Evan, just another program on an NPR station saying that socks are racist and saying that, you know, the clothes you wear are racist and the car you drive is racist and everything is racist. I thought that extra headline's important because when we are talking about racial inequity and some of these sort of tangled up issues, no one is saying that climate change itself is racist. It is the systems and how the impact hits people that does have, based on plenty of the evidence I've read, a significant imbalance. And understanding that, I think, is important. We're going to talk about that with Dr. Turan. But do you want to talk a little bit about some of the mentality of trying to understand all these overlapping and sort of interlocking pieces here?
You know, it is something that I am still trying to unpack and learn about because it's just complex, right? We have these systems of inequity that exist, racism being one of them, but also patriarchy, the extractive economy, you know, the forces that are trying to dismantle our democracy right now, today, right? And how all of these things play together and contribute to the ecological crises that we are facing is a fascinating topic that, you know, again, we invite people to come to the summit and really dig in because there's a lot to unpack there.
Okay. And Dr. Turan, if I could start with you on some of these, we'll kind of start more broadly and then we're going to talk very specifically about some of the things that you've written and some of the issues that you might be focusing on here. But in general, how important is it that some of the work that is done in climate action understands the concepts that we're talking about here? And I'm wondering what happens if there's a climate action movement without kind of an equity piece in mind.
Well, there can be. Is it going to be a responsible movement without thinking about things like inequality and environmental racism and environmental justice? It would be inadequate. And let me just take two steps back. I'm really appreciative of your framing, referring to this as environmental racism, because a lot of times we deal and contend with terms like environmental inequality or environmental justice. Very important concepts, but they can be amorphous concepts. When we're talking about environmental racism, it's obviously something that has a gravity that we have to deal with and contend with. So absolutely. And just in thinking about how you kind of preface this entire conversation, climate change is not racist, but certainly systems and processes and absolutely outcomes can be racist. So when we're thinking about energy transitions, we got to ask some serious questions. Who's going to have access to renewable energy jobs? Who's not going to have access? What communities are most impacted by energy burdens? What communities are most impacted? Communities like Rochester. These aren't places, you know, 8,000 miles away. Places like Syracuse, New York. Places like Buffalo. What neighborhoods within these cities are going to be most burdened by things like extreme heat and urban heat islands?
Well, on your website, you write the following. You write, renewable energy transitions must center marginalized communities regarding access to technology, workforce development, and community health, while also prioritizing conservation and weatherization, end quote. So what does it look like when that doesn't happen? And do you think, Dr. Turan, that more often than not, that is not happening?
Well, when it doesn't happen, think about that tour of cities I just gave. If you think about the status quo of who has access to the workforce, when you think about how concentrated poverty is racialized, if you have an energy transition that is not centering justice along racial lines, gender lines, social inequality lines, then you're going to have a replication of the 20th century. And that concentrated poverty that you have in places like Rochester and Syracuse, Buffalo, that's going to be replicated. So yes, we want to see more community solar. We want to see more homes weatherized into the future. But if we have racialized economies where not everybody can partake in those workforces, then I don't think you're going to see benefits and impacts that are systemically altering across racial lines.
Dr. Van Dis, when we think about inequity in terms of health outcomes, what are you seeing and what do you want to make sure that people understand here?
Well, what I take care of, I take care of pregnant women, Evan, and what I see are that the way in which climate change is affecting patients is unequal. So, for instance, you see places that don't have as many trees, don't have as many green spaces. Those urban heat islands, of which 40 million Americans live in such a place, they might experience a heat index 10 to 20 degrees higher than their suburban, leafy cohorts. And I specifically take care of pregnant women, so I can see the effects of heat on pregnancy. So heat waves impact pregnancy, and they increase the risk of stillbirth, they increase the risk of low birth weight, they increase the risk of preterm birth. So heat in and of itself can be expressed as an inequity, even in the same city. So places in Rochester might be actually, as I said, 10 to 20 degrees hotter than their suburban counterparts, and that's having an effect on health.
Is it a set of policy changes that starts to address that? Is it better community education on how these issues are sort of intersecting? What are the steps?
Well, I'm not a government official, but I mean, I would say,
Dr. Mendes says, do not make me create policy.
Well, I would say plant trees. And I would say, you know, there's lots of housing policies that affect the conditions that people live in. As we know, the redlining that occurred here in Rochester created communities that are exposed to higher rates of pollution. Pollution increases the risk for preterm birth as well. So there are so many ways in which our racist history absolutely affects the conditions that are presenting at the University of Rochester Medical Center today. So we actually really need to unpack the types of risks that we're putting, for pregnant women in.
Well, you actually did just kind of give us a policy idea there, Dr. Van Dis, especially when it comes to the notion of planting trees, and not necessarily indiscriminately, but actually intentionally in places where
urban
they haven't
reforestation.
Been. There's a couple of points on that. Mode there. We talked last year about where the trees in Rochester are and where they aren't.
That's right.
And I want to read a little bit of what Dr. Turan has written about this in a piece called Inequality, Urban Heat, and Crime. Dr. Turan writes, quote, most of us have heard folklore regarding summertime heat and violence. Sun's out, guns out. Trees, or the dearth of, made me think about these impacts from a research perspective. I was working in upstate New York, making the rounds trying to get community members excited about our urban forestry and environmental justice work. I'd present at neighborhood association meetings, and invariably, a police officer presenting on local crime would be positioned on the agenda either just before or right after my presentation. Intuitively, I saw that many of the same neighborhoods at greatest risk of exposure to urban heat anomalies, largely due to inordinate amounts of impervious surface cover and a complementary deficit of trees and other vegetation, were the neighborhoods that seemed most exposed to reported crimes, shots fired, and gun crimes, end quote. Dr. Tron, can you elaborate on some of those points and tell us more on that?
Yeah, and I also, and I'm very thankful you brought up that piece. You actually make my work sound good. I hope I record that. But now I'm really glad that the professor, Dr. Van Diss, has brought up inequalities, not just suburban city divides, but you have intra-city divides. So neighborhoods, this is widespread of temperatures within cities due to a legacy of planning mistakes that led to inordinate amounts of impervious surface. But yes, I want to be very careful. We can't be too reductionist and just say, hey, neighborhoods that are vulnerable to urban heat, those are also going to be places that have a proliferation of shots fired, because that can lead to some pretty ugly, pernicious, reductionist, environmental racist comments and arguments of their own. Are you saying that neighborhoods with higher concentrated or poor people and that are also hot inherently violent? No, that's not what I'm saying. So thank you for breaking that down. But look, when we think about gun violence, that's just one aspect of public health. And then when we couple that with climate change, we know that climate change destabilizes and undermines all types of aspects of public health, whether it be gun violence, whether it be access to safe food and healthy water, whether it be access to cool conditions. So as we mentioned and talk a little bit more about the social determinants of health and also the environmental determinants of health, that's when we got to contextualize this with extreme heat. And we know that climate change is going to undermine many aspects of public safety. Violence is just one of those things.
But let me also ask about the way kind of movements form and the way people feel either activated or sometimes paralyzed. And it's something that, you know, in various flavors, Abby and I have talked about on this program, but I want to talk about it in the context of what this summit is focusing on. And it sounds, some of the despair that I hear sometimes, whether it's in the form of emails or phone calls, sounds like this. It sounds like, oh, climate change is this massive problem. It's not impossible, but it is very, very hard to move people in power and get policy done, get change done. And then the notions of historic inequality, racism, injustice are massive problems. But when you tangle them together, it feels like I take one step forward and two steps back, and can we really solve anything? And people start to feel like it is really, really complex to try to solve these issues and to do them in a way that also promotes the equity that hasn't been there, the justice that hasn't always been there. And Dr. Tehran, can you, you know, talk for a little bit, and I would ask all of our guests to do this, about why you think it is imperative to, I mean, there's a lot of different versions of this, to unlearn power, as you've written, but also that you believe these problems can be solved, and they can be solved despite the complexity, despite the challenge of understanding the overlapping structures and pieces here.
Right. So how do we unlearn power? One of the things that we have to do is, since you mentioned community impetus and community involvement, what we do in our lab is what we call public science. So we give community members, lay populations, tools that we use as professional foresters and planners, tools to create their own prioritization strategies. So as our good doctor said earlier, yes, let's plant trees, but I want to make sure that communities are equipped with the tools so that they can create their own prioritization strategies. Well, I want the trees on this block, and here's why. And when we give people science tools, then it's not just somebody saying, hey, environmental racism happened in the 20th century due to public planning, redlining, or the homeowners loan corporation. It's people saying, hey, based on the inordinate amount of, say, high school dropouts, high poverty levels, elderly populations, or advanced youth populations, these are the reasons why we want to prioritize trees in our community to go along with the many environmental benefits like floodwater mitigation, like particulate matter capture, which is particularly important in high respiratory illness communities. So it's going to be all about prioritization driven by communities. But at the same time, let me just add one more thing. We can't put too much weight on community because we got to also think about power structures. Yes, we want neighborhoods to be animated, but we also got to ask power structures, or we got to demand that power structures stop with so much of the climate pollution that's being pervaded.
So we're going to come back to that subject of power in just a moment. Abby, you want to talk a little about the challenge of keeping movements really energized and activated while embracing the complexity of taking steps in a way that honor all of the threads that we're talking about here?
Yeah. I can certainly relate to and understand why people feel overwhelmed by this issue. It's a lot. That's real. And anyone who is thinking and feeling that, like, yes, you're on the right track. But to me, I think just personally gone from that place of despair and overwhelm to really feeling hopeful and optimistic about the possibility to create a better future. I'm glad, in fact, that we don't have to just address greenhouse gas emissions in isolation on its own, and we have the opportunity to create a healthier, more equitable, and regenerative community in the process, where people have jobs and services, then easy access to that, a transportation system that really serves, buildings that are comfortable and healthy to be in. So, when we start unpacking the connection between climate and health, there's a lot of things we could talk about, kind of under that big umbrella. We've touched on a few of them already today, but there's much, much more. So we know that our community here in Rochester is experiencing a lot of different challenges. So can we be strategic about how we use climate solutions? We know we have this, global crisis to address. How can we do it in a way that really addresses some of those systemic inequalities and just makes life better for people?
Dr. Van Dis, do you want to weigh in on that too?
Yeah, and I think, I definitely, to echo both of you speaking, that I've definitely felt overwhelmed at time. As a physician, I work full time. I'm a single mom. But I do think that, for me, I'll speak solely for myself. I look for small little projects at the University of Rochester that I can accomplish. So, for instance, I do a lot of C-sections. I'm in the operating room. And I was noting that there were times when we would have four trash bins in the operating room. Two were for linens and two were for a red bag, which is incinerated waste, which obviously costs a lot of money but puts a lot of emissions up into the air because you have to burn it at really high heat. And there was not a receptacle for regular trash. So it took, I'm not kidding, it took literally 40 to 50 emails, multiple visits with people in environmental services. And now I can say for the most part, although last week there was no regular trash bin, for the most part, we have a regular trash bin in the operating rooms on labor and delivery, and hopefully people are sorting appropriately. Now, this is probably, to your listeners, seems like the tiniest little thing, but I checked it off, mission accomplished. So that means, okay, what's the next thing? I would love to see at the University of Rochester Medical Center's cafeteria vegetarian and vegan options. A lot of people don't know, but 15% of all of healthcare's greenhouse gas emissions come from the cafeteria. So we in Rochester, and Abby knows more about this than I do, there are so many great resources for local food, regenerative ag, companies that are doing great things that if we could connect them to the University of Rochester's Medical Center's cafeteria, the staff would get better meals, the patients would get healthier meals, there'd be potentially more, less industrial agriculture in our food that has harmful components to it. That's a little bit of a bigger lift than fixing the trash bins in the operating room. But there's all sorts of little ways that I get energized in the face of so much overwhelming statistics to try and make a difference.
So it sounds like part of your strategy is to find achievable, if difficult, goals and to just kind of be relentless until you can move to the next one. Is that fair?
That is fair. The other one that I'm super psyched about, and we, we've actually, all, I think Abby can say this as well, you have to build coalitions, I believe, within the climate movement. So one of the things that we've been doing, Dr. Valerie Liu and I, we tried to look at the carbon emissions of metal speculums versus plastic speculums used in the emergency room. And we know, for instance, that plastic speculums are five times the global greenhouse gas emissions from metal. URMC currently uses all single-use plastic. And we actually took apart one of these speculums, and inside there were two of those little nickel-cadmium batteries. So every time for 30 seconds that we use that speculum, we're throwing it in the trash. So not only the plastic, but then the batteries are going in the trash. And you know who's excited to tackle this? The medical students. The medical students for sustainability. So we get them involved. Now, I would love to see more coalition building at the university across other specialties. So nursing or the environmental services people. Like maybe we all actually want to combat climate change, but we don't know each other exists. So how can we work together? How can we find each other?
Well, and so maybe this is a good point to ask our guest on the line about this question about power. So Dr. Lamir Turan, who's with us, an associate professor in the Department of Earth, Environment, and Equity at Howard University, and is coming to be part of this event, this summit next weekend, has written a lot and said a lot about power. In fact, Dr. Turan writes on his website, it's essential that we unlearn power. This includes not only rethinking our energy systems, but also social structures that marginalize people and place while exacerbating environmental threats. And even in the story of the operating room, it's an interesting story about how difficult it is to change even small parts of a system. So on one hand, you have Dr. Van Dis, who as someone who literally operates on patients, does a lot of C-sections. I mean, this is someone who's held in high regard, has a sense of prestige or power, perhaps. But Dr. Van Dis also implored me not to refer to her as just a professor. Assistant professor, she said, that's the appropriate title. It was a humble but accurate way of describing her and making sure that I didn't unduly promote Dr. Van Dis, although I would if I could. So this is someone who has a sense of a very important place in university, not at the perhaps top of the power structure, but still wanted to shake things up within the operating room, trying to make a small change. And it still took dozens of emails, and not necessarily because some corporate structure said, no, we want to burn everything that comes out of there, but because inertia is powerful. And just changing anything small, a lot, oftentimes people in power think, well, it's already working. I don't want to change it. I mean, it took us a long time to just put regular old mugs in the studio, not plastic bottles. And Abby was here. Every time Abby would come in with the plastic bottles, I would hide under this desk. But the change was slow. Inertia is strong, and then it can happen. When it comes to understanding power and why you want us to unlearn power, Dr. Turan, can you describe the ways that you would ask people to think about power and the ways that the actual physical work of unlearning power can actually happen?
How do we think about power? It begins with what our coalitions look like. And let me take a step back. I'm going to promote Professor Van Dis or Dr. Van Dis, the full professor, because I think I added a syllable to your name. I added a syllable. So for that alone, you're now endowed chair. But what does it look like? What do these coalitions look like? Excuse me. First thing I ask when I go into a room, where's labor at? So yes, we need these university-based, research-based coalitions, but on the ground, who's fighting with researchers? So where's labor at? A few years ago, I did a seminar for the AFL-CIO's retired affiliate. These are retired persons who wanted to talk with me and my research cohort about climate change. So if we don't have a coalition of not just the doctors, the MDs, the PhDs, and every other D you can imagine, labor, retired folks, young folk, that's where coalition building begins, and that's how we initiate action against power structures, right? We got to have people. And how does that manifest? How does that articulate itself? It articulates itself in many fashions. We were talking about the food system earlier. What do coalitions look like? What do cooperatives look like in terms of where we get our produce, where we get our food? What do cooperatives look like in terms of our energy systems? Does that articulate itself in, say, community solar or reimagined wind power? Perhaps they do. But the work, when we democratize this work through coalition building, that's how we begin to unlearn power.
So where, Abby McHugh Griffith, do you see the most frustrating entrenched power in the work that you're doing? And because I'm thinking of, I think it's a Frederick Douglass quote about, you know, power doesn't give up power without a struggle. I mean, it's in that spirit. Sorry that I am on the fly. I should have looked that up. I will look it up.
Power concedes nothing without a demand, maybe.
Thank you, Professor. Certainly that has proven true. Where do you see power most entrenched that hasn't budged much, Abby?
No comment? No, just kidding.
No, come on.
Oh, my God.
You know, so There are certainly community leaders in Rochester, who I will not name by name, but who have not fully embraced the need for climate action. That's a real thing, right? We have local people in positions of power who, if they decided to prioritize this issue, we would see a lot faster progress. Now, that said, I think we also need to be careful of kind of like the just the binary of people with power, people without power, because there is no one who does not have power on this issue or who can't do something. But I do think there are people who haven't yet discovered their power or tapped into their personal power. So I think like Jane's example of she wanted something done and she was persistent, sent email after email after email until someone responded and the change was made. There's power in that persistence for sure. And just being the person who is willing to maybe ask the uncomfortable question or to kind of, you know, be a little thorn in the side of someone who could make the decision to implement change. So, you know, I just think we need to recognize that when it comes to an issue like the climate crisis, we can't wait for or rely on a few people in positions at the top to get stuff done. We need to all find the opportunities where we can seize our own power and exercise that power.
Let me take some of your feedback, listeners, and I'm going to start with Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. It reminds me of what your guest said about FDR when people were coming to him with really good ideas, but he says, you need to make me. You know, in other words, you keep protesting, keep it in the news, and you don't give up, so that all I can do is say, well, I've got to go along with these protesters. And you wouldn't say it like that, but it's up to us to make sure they hear us and we're not shutting up. But one thing that puzzles me, Evan, and it bothers me, and it is to do with what you're talking about, but do you remember when they told us they were dumping all that radioactive waste in the Hudson River? You do remember that, don't you?
I mean, it doesn't surprise me. The specific story is not a surprise, Jane. I don't know when you're talking about.
Okay. Well, what puzzles me is it disappeared, as far as I could tell, from the radio, from the news. You know, we had a little bit of a flurry of talking about it for a week or two, and I've noticed this on a lot of environmental pollution stories. I've noticed they'll flash it up, another oil spill, and then it just quietly goes away. And I think that does have to, they quieten down. And I had a really good friend, a retired Marine in intelligence, and I told him about, I can't remember exactly what it was now, but it had to do with contamination in Kentucky that hit the airways for a half a week. And I said, did you see it? He said, no. And I can tell you, you'll never hear it again. Because somebody got to somebody and shut them up. But I want to say that it concerns me, because not only have we screwed up in the past, polluting and contaminating everything, but we are gung-ho doing it again with this dumping into the Hudson River and so little outrage. So that bothers me, and I get your point about they screw over people that they deem less powerless for whatever reasons more than they do the wealthy. But this in the Hudson River cuts right through New York, and they're very wealthy people up there. I wonder what happened. But anyway, I'll shut up now and get an answer.
No, Jane, there's actually a lot there, and I'm glad that your call hits as it does now, because it directs us to a real tangible question of human health is affected by racist, sometimes classist, unjust climate policy. So I don't know the exact Hudson River story you're talking about, Jane, but I do know a Kentucky story that you alluded to, because I took my first job out of college in 2001 in Charleston, West Virginia, and I covered the coal industry a lot. And about a year, October 2000, I think, and our producers will fact check me on this, but I think it was October 2000 that one of the biggest environmental disasters hit the eastern United States. It was a coal slurry spill that happened in Kentucky, and it went into the rivers, 200 miles of riverways. You can still see pictures of the gray-black sludge that overwhelmed fish and wildlife. But what it also did, Jane, it did a couple of things. There was some waterway, some land, private land, some pretty big houses along rivers, and that land also got affected. I mean, it killed grass, it killed just about everything it touched. And the wealthy people were very, very angry about this. And so they wanted a promise of cleanup, and they wanted money spent, and they mostly got it. It also basically overwhelmed local parks, playgrounds in poorer areas, things like that, that took a long time to get addressed. They were not as addressed nearly as quickly as the private land with, you know, the big mansion on the top of the hill that overlooked the river, and now you got sludge because of this coal slurry impoundment spill. It was an impoundment break. Now I'm getting back in my West Virginia geeky reporting days. But to me, what ended up happening was it killed a lot of wildlife. It affected the lands of people, the land that was used by people who did not have means more, because the wealthy people, they got very quick action. And the people who didn't have much didn't. There were people who lived in very small areas, trailers right along the water. It was very sad to look at some of the pictures, and you can find them on Google. But in covering that story for months when I got to West Virginia, because the outcome was still happening by the time I got hired, it was amazing to me how almost people just kind of shrugged. It was like, well, you know, if you don't have resources, like, what are you going to do? Like, I guess your land is ruined, and I guess whatever. And people didn't even seem moved by it. People that I interviewed, I was 22 years old. And so that's what stands out to me. And that's one small example, because when we talk about how climate can impact people in unequal ways, I saw it when I was 22. And I say that, well, how is that a climate change issue? It's the coal industry. It's a fossil fuel industry. That's right. And they regularly skirted the rules on how safe the impoundments had to be. By the time I was 23, I was trying to sort through 400 pages of documents on this massive coal impoundment. And I went, I don't think I'm qualified for this. But safe to say, there were a lot of people working for the government who had worked in the coal industry, and they were able to break a lot of rules. And then these disasters hit. And guess who gets affected more? So, Jane, that's what comes to mind for me. I want our guests to all explain a little bit of how they see health outcomes tied to these issues in inequitable or unjust ways. And let me start with Dr. Turan, if you want to hit that, Doctor.
Yeah, so many health outcomes that we see exacerbated by climate inequality, many of those are particularly most impactful along gender lines. So we know after so-called natural disasters, a lot of times we see violent spikes amongst women and girls. So that would be one manifestation. Prolonged drought certainly undermines your agricultural system. And when people can't get food and sustenance, that's going to have spillover social and economic effects that can potentially destabilize an entire society. And then just beyond that, just to preface it along the lines of social determinants of health, you know, if the fabric of society begins to rupture along socioeconomic lines, then what does that mean in terms of, will you have hospitals to go to in 10 years? Will you have school systems that produce the next crop of climate scientists or epidemiologists or welders or whatever, you know, vocation we're talking about? So those are just a few ways that climate and environmental inequality generally can undermine life quality.
And Dr. Van Dis, you talked about this in your opening remarks. You want to add to that?
Well, I would just say, you know, one of the things that I think about, I'm a climate refugee in a way. I moved here from California 2.5 years ago because of the fires and because of the heat. There and even here in Rochester, I take care of women who are pregnant who are working outside. And one important thing to know is that there is no federal legislation protecting outdoor workers from heat. So we know that there are people who work in agriculture, in the fields, who literally die in the field from heat stroke. And yet there are certain states that have passed legislation, but there is no federal support for legislation for the people that bring us our food. And I'm oftentimes seeing women in triage, you know, helping them with their conditions. And so it's really important that we as healthcare providers providers too think about what types of exposures our patients have, whether it's in their home, in the type of work that they do. I would say that a lot of physicians probably don't necessarily feel like they have sufficient education to take an environmental health history. But I'm actually thinking of trying to do a study so that I can then take that information to the American College of OBGYN and say, listen, it's an unfunded mandate that we're supposed to have time in prenatal care to ask our patients about their exposures to whether it's pollution or heat. It's all about timing and billing and, you know, healthcare being a business and all of that. But we actually need the time and the space to be able to make sure that our patients are safe, that they're safe at home, and that they're safe where they're working.
Abby?
Well, I think it's just important to point out that we have our own very local examples with contamination and pollution. I'm thinking about the Inplex. Remind me what the site is called, the vacuum oil site.
There in the are also, Plex neighborhood? Yeah.
Yep, of course, brownfields all over the city that have various different forms of contamination. I know in the Beechwood neighborhood, they were advocating for, you know, a really thorough cleanup of an old mining and dumping site there. And especially those neighborhoods where, you know, perhaps there isn't someone who has kind of existing power within the structure that exists. You know, advocating for that, the progress can be kind of mind-bogglingly slow on getting some of these issues addressed. So these are local issues, local concerns. And when you think about climate change and how, you know, that's impacting us, I think it's absolutely correct to point to the disproportionate impact on vulnerable populations, but also recognizing that we are at a point where it doesn't matter who you are and how much privilege and wealth you have, climate change is harming you too. So thinking about things like the wildfire smoke last summer, right? We all breathe the same air mostly, kind of. I mean, I could put some asterisks on that. But to the extent that we need clean air, clean water, you know, healthy, safe food, we rely on these things for our survival. So it is in our common shared interest to take care of this planet that sustains us.
And thank you to producer Megan Mack for confirming. It's the Martin County coal sludge spill, if you want to look it up. Wikipedia's got its own page on it. The pictures are very sad to see, but that was October 2000. I didn't think I'd be going back to my West Virginia days this hour, but here we are. Back to your feedback. This is Bonnie in Rochester. Hi, Bonnie. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Well, a few months ago, you were talking about issues that are affected by the heat, which in the summer can be pretty difficult. I want to make a couple comments about that. One is, and then talked about trees too, our neighborhood association gave to city council and to the mayor a full list of things that we thought we really needed. And one of them was that we have a lot of older trees in the city, especially because we have older homes and in the backyards are older big trees. So you want to keep those trees. However, the system that you need to keep trees, big trees especially, you know, trimmed and all that, is very expensive. People don't have the money, $1,000, to do this or do that. So, but we have a forestry department, and that forestry department, in talking to them, would be very willing to help do that. But we haven't had any movement on the part of the elected folks to do that. The second thing I want to make connection with heat is that a few years ago, the city council and I think the county figured out a way to get air conditioners for people, and they actually got mostly the portable ones. That was a few years ago. We really need that right now. We need a commitment for that kind of service and help. And I heard on the radio the other day that, I don't know the name of the group, but there's a women's group in Europe that's been, you know, fighting for quite a few months over this issue. And they just got some national or international award for as a peacekeeping group for that work that they've done. So if people can do this, we can vocally do it. We can do it from a body of others that have indicated how important this is, and we can stop trying to make excuses, say why we can't do it. You know, and on the forestry issue, a lot of times the forestry people don't even get involved. with things that are up their knowledge alley, and we need to make sure that's happening. And I'm sorry, but it isn't happening right now.
Bonnie, I appreciate the phone call, and there's a lot of passion there. I don't know what to say other than, Dr. Van Dis is going to look at me. Anything to add to what you heard from Bonnie? Abby, anything you want to weigh in there?
I think bringing up the air conditioning, I really appreciate that specifically. Mm-hmm. And what it makes me think about is the need to really be strategic in how we deploy solutions and, to the extent possible, to go for the win-win or win-win-win solutions, right? How can we address multiple problems at one time? So we want, of course, to be keeping people healthy and safe during extreme heat events. We also know that we need to be reducing energy usage and our reliance on fossil fuels. So instead of investing in giving people, let's say window air conditioning units, let's go all the way and invest in heat pumps that will provide clean heat and cooling in a safe way and in a way that addresses the climate impacts over the long term.
Bonnie, thank you. Let me read an email that came in. I got a couple of emails I want to read in. Charles says he wants to know about why we're not broadcasting this hour focused on private jets in China. He says, shouldn't you be directing your energy at people actually causing the climate problem? I'll believe there's a climate crisis when you do. He's saying, if we're not talking about China and private jets, we're not serious about climate change. All right, Abby, what do you think?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that the United States is responsible historically for far more emissions than China. Their overall emissions are now higher than ours, but historically, our emissions are higher, and per capita, our emissions continue to be higher. So blaming this on the Chinese is just unfair, quite simply unfair. And I saw Jane's hand go up, so I'm going to pass it on.
Go ahead.
Well, I will just say, I think a lot of the public doesn't know, but 10% of all U.S. greenhouse gases come from U.S. healthcare. Healthcare is oftentimes overlooked as a polluting enterprise. Aviation, if you count the aerosols from the water vapor, is only 4%. So healthcare is literally 2.5 times the amount of emissions as aviation. We do think about private jets. We think about jet fuel. But we actually should be thinking about what we can do in healthcare to decarbonize. In addition, I will say, big oil did the research in the 50s and 60s. They saw this coming. Their researchers told them what was going to happen. And I've heard that their research actually is pretty on par with what we're seeing. And so to that vein, obviously, big oil also knows that a great thing to do would be to get society addicted to plastic, because 10 to 12% of all global oil goes into plastic. And who uses more plastic than any other industry in America? It's healthcare. U.S. healthcare uses more single-use plastic than the entire country of the U.K. So while it's interesting to look at what others can do, it's really interesting also to think about what we need to do, and it's to decarbonize and get rid of plastic.
Okay. Do you want to hit this as well, Dr. Turan?
Yeah, I'll just say, I don't know the spirit of the email, if it came from a place of climate denialism, but I think it is fair to critique industry, right? Whether those industries be agriculture, shipping industry, petrochemical buildings, like all these things are great purveyors of greenhouse gases. So there has to be a critique of industry. Otherwise, we're not unlearning power.
Okay. And Abby, one other point. I mean, I take your point that we've historically been a bigger polluter than China. They've passed us only recently in emissions. It is still an issue. I mean, China, United States, the biggest producers and the biggest contributors. I mean, I don't run the Chinese government, but I am concerned about what they are doing. I don't know what people ought to do about that, but it's not a non-factor, right?
It's not a non-factor. We could also point to the degree to which China is deploying solar at a much faster rate than we are here in the United States. So there's things to celebrate about what China is doing, as well as things to critique. But at the end of the day, looking at where do we hold power, we as citizens of the United States have some, you know, reflecting on our own way of life, our own contribution to the problem, and to take responsibility to that. I mean, you know, we pride ourselves in America as being real innovators and global leaders. So let's live into that by taking this issue seriously and taking responsibility for our own contribution.
Connections listeners are sending me emails updating me on the whole coal slurry disaster. There's threads I did not know about that illustrate our guest points about power. So just listen to some of these details that I didn't even know about. Again, in October 2000, a big coal slurry impoundment. And all that means is when you mine coal, you have to clean it. You have to use chemicals. That creates kind of a sludgy, thick material. They call it slurry or coal sludge. You got to put it somewhere. And they often will literally put a waste rock dam, and they will fill up these valleys. And from the air, they look like lakes until you realize they are black, gray coal slurry. And they say, don't worry, that will never get into your groundwater or go underground because we know there's enough bedrock to protect the environment. Only they're often skirting the rules because the former coal officials are now in the government who are supposed to be overseeing the rules. So in October 2000, one of these things breaks into the water under the mine, and it goes for hundreds of miles, and it wipes out wildlife, and it's a disaster. It was 300 million gallons of this stuff. So that was 2000. What happens in 2002? Well, who was the senator from Kentucky? Mitch McConnell. Who is his wife? Elaine Chao, who was the U.S. Secretary of Labor overseeing the Mine Safety and Health Administration. So the federal penalty for one of the biggest environmental disasters ever was $5,600.
Oh, my God.
$5,600. By the way, the owner of that mine was Massey Energy. They were one of the biggest contributors to the Bush administration in political money.
And isn't Joe Manchin related to Massey Energy?
I don't know if Joe was, but I can tell you that a guy named Don Blankenship, this is another thing somebody just sent me. He was the CEO.
Yeah.
And Don is almost a caricature of like a coal baron. He lives on a mountaintop mansion. And he actually went to prison for a year in 2016 because, not because of this, but because people in one of his mines died and he was not really interested in the safety quality there. So he goes to prison. He comes out. In 2018, he ran for U.S. Senate as a Republican. He called himself Trumpier than Trump. He did not win. And what somebody just sent me a note that he just changed his parties and he's going to run as a Democrat this year. He says he's fired up because he's tired of the Republicans. He's back. So this guy still has his mansion. He's got all the money. He's got all the power. And now he wants to be in government. And so look at that 25-year legacy of one of the biggest environmental disasters. $5,600 was the fine. And the CEO wants to be in the Senate 25 years later. That's power. That's power. So thank you, Connections listeners, for filling me in on some of that stuff there. I appreciate that. Finally, let me read an email from Tim. Tim says, Evan, I think your guests are making a lot of good points. But my concern would be that I try to do my part. I'm busy. I'm a dad. I've got two kids. But if I try to do my part and then someone tells me, actually, what I've been doing is racist, it's going to be hard to continue with some of the work. Can your guests address that? That's from Tim. I don't think the guests are saying that. But Abby, you want to start? What would you say to Tim? He's worried that with all of the intersecting threads here, he's going to do the wrong thing in climate action and then get accused of fostering injustice instead of trying to fight it. What would you say, Abby?
Well, first of all, I'd say thank you, Tim, for making an effort to figure out what your piece of your contribution to this work is. And it's to be expected that it might be bumpy and there might be things along the way where you look back and are like, whoops, that wasn't maybe the best, course of action, but you can always change course. And I'm just saying this from my own personal experience, having gotten into this work about a decade ago with no idea what I was doing. I have certainly made mistakes. There are certainly things where, my energy and attention was focused. It could have been more strategic at the outset. And, I wish at the time that we'd had a really strong, local climate movement that could have pointed me in a better direction, but we do have that now. So I would invite you to check out the Genesee Finger Lakes Regional Climate Action Strategy, which lays out, where are our local emissions coming from and what are the mitigation measures that we really should be prioritizing to make sure we're not either just wasting our energy, and by that I mean your own personal energy, or going down a path that could ultimately be harmful. Because it is legitimately hard to figure out if you don't have the experience with it. So would invite you, Tim, to plug into our local movement and we can help guide you in the right direction and support you.
Dr. Turan, what would you say to Tim?
Yeah, so I can't speak to Tim's actions or inactions. What I'm interested in is talking about systems. We talked about not having national, much less international protection for farm workers in extreme heat seasons. That's a moral disgrace that has environmental racist implications. So let's talk about systems, what individuals are doing. Like, it's fun to talk about, I guess, but let's talk about structural inequality. That's what's really going to move the needle.
And anything you want to add there, Jane?
No, I appreciated both statements. They were really good.
So let's wrap with this. Abby McHugh-Griffa, there's an event coming up next Friday and Saturday, and registration closes on Monday. It's your annual summit. Tell listeners who missed it what you want them to experience with that.
Yeah, so our focus is health, equity, and climate. We will dig into all the many issues that fall under that big umbrella. My two fellow panelists here today will be some of the speakers, but we have many, many more experts who will really help guide us in learning about this issue, not just what the problem is, but what the solutions are, what we can do about it. So you can register for one day, you can register for 2 days, go to the website, climategfl.org, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Do you have members of government interested in events like this?
You know, this year's summit, we have not focused on targeting members of government to participate. We are actually much more focused this year on the healthcare sector, of course. But we do have local electeds who do care very much about this issue. And we have others who we are encouraging to care more.
Okay. Well, there's still time anyway. Mm-hmm. Registration closes on Monday. We'll have a link to registration in our show notes when this show is posted. Do you want to direct folks again to a website?
ClimateGFL.org.
Abby McHugh-Griffa is the Executive Director of the Climate Solutions Accelerator of the Genesee Finger Lakes Region. Thank you, as always, for being here. We appreciate the conversation.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks to Dr. Jane Van Dis, who is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thanks for being here. Thanks for sharing your expertise.
Thanks, Evan. And I just want to say, I actually have a website. Can I give it?
Please.
It's www.obg4sf.org. And we're OBGYNs for Sustainable Future.
OBG4SF.org. OBG4SF.org. Thank you for being here. And Dr. Lamir Turan is an associate professor in the Department of Earth, Environment, and Equity at Howard University. See you in Rochester soon. Thank you, Dr. Turan.
Thank you, Evan. I'll plug my site too, unlearnpower.org. Check us out. We're not selling anything. Take care, folks.
Unlearnpower.org is the website. From the whole team at Connections, it's Mari and Evan and Megan and Rob saying thank you for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.